Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. Today it is Saturday, December the 19th. Live here from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, with your host Denise Turney for Off the Shelf. And it's actually snowing here in Philadelphia. They had been saying the last few days that we were going to get snow, and a lot of it, anywhere from 8 to 20 inches. And it's starting to come down now. So we are honored to have somebody from the sunny California, the West Coast, Maxine Thompson. I'm sure it's not snowing out there. Maxine, just to let you know, she is. I'm just so delighted to have her with us on Off the Shelf. She is a literary agent who has landed writer's book contracts with mainstream book publishers. She's the owner of Maxine Thompson Literary Services and Literary Agency. Maxine is also the host of the Dr. Maxine Radio Show. This is a truly phenomenal woman. She's an editor, a former social worker, and she is also the author of the books, one of my absolute favorites, The Ebony Tree. If you don't have it, I encourage you to run out and get this book. To me, it's a classic. She also is the author of No Pockets in the Shroud, and she has other books that have been part of a compilation, stories that have been part of a compilation of books. Her works have been picked up by Black Expressions, which is the largest African-American book club in the United States, so that's quite an accomplishment. And she's also the author of the new book, Hostage of Lies. Maxine Thompson has appeared on radio, television, and in newspapers and magazines around the United States. Welcome to Off the Shelf, Maxine.
Well, thank you so much, Denise, for having me. It's an honor to be on your show. I've seen you out here for years, you know, promoting authors tirelessly. I came on your Off the Shelf show about 4 or 5 years ago. I was down in San Diego at a hotel when I called in, so now you're on Blog Talk, but I'm just proud to see that you're just hanging in here. And I must say that Hostage of Lies is actually the reissued version of No Pockets in a Shroud. It had a really good edit on it. I think it's a better book for it. I'm under Urban Books. Kensington is the distributor, and the editing just found so many things that I think fine-tuned the book. And so that's just to show, just like Push, it came out in 97. I first published this book in 1997, and then I reissued it in 2000, a better version. But now here it's in hardback and in paperback with nation and international distribution, but it started out self-published. So that's just to tell writers, never give up.
Oh, that's an excellent start to our interview, Maxine, and thank you for sharing that. I know No Pockets in the Shroud was the first book that preceded, if I'm not mistaken, The Ebony Tree. I have to read No Pockets in the Shroud. The Ebony Tree really, really touched me. It's a true classic. It's a true classic mother-daughter relationship book in my eyes, and one of the very, very best that I have read, and I've read a lot of books.
That was my first. Actually, The Ebony Tree was my first, and I wrote it in response to my mother's death. I had been doing short stories and so forth, and when she died, that was one of my second after the shock was, she never got to see a book that I published. So I wrote that about a year after she died, once I got through the worst part of the grief. And it's based on her life loosely, you know.
Okay. To our listeners, I don't do this often. I do encourage people to support the guest on Off the Shelf, but The Ebony Tree, I don't often say, and I don't think I have before, that a book is a classic in my eyes, but The Ebony Tree definitely is. And you, as you were alluding to when you, at the start of the interview, we both kind of, our paths crossed early, I think, in our careers, our writing careers, and working as independent publishers. And I wanted to ask you, I know you said how you got started writing The Ebony Tree was your first book that you wrote, really a book about sort of your relationship with your mother or about your mother after she had passed. But I wanted to ask you, how did you get started in the literary field? You do so much now, editing, literary agent, writer, so many things. How did you get started in the book business, Maxine?
Well, I had read Dan Pointer's self-published book in the early 90s, and I did part of what he said, but I still didn't have the confidence. I had gotten my business license, and then in 95, my mother died in 94, and actually it's going back into her mother's life and the grandmother, you know, following the line of women, just showing how this thing of secrecy and that distance between mother and daughter was affected by slavery. If your daughter could be sold from you or could be given to the masters, it was hard for you to bond. And that's why they all, I think that's where that expression, black mothers love their sons and raise their daughters, you know, and where they teach them to be strong and then let the sons be kind of lacking. But I got started also in 1989. Well, I had been writing poetry. I was going to poetry conferences all in the 80s. And then in 89, I won $1,000 in Ebony's first writing contest. It was a runner-up.
Oh, congratulations. I remember when I used to run that. I remember when that first came out. And the owner, John Johnson, did it in honor of his mother, actually.
Right.
He started the writing contest.
Yeah, and they were only going to give out the $5,000. I think it was the Rooster or something was the winner. But then they ended up giving out $1,000. And they said, we know there's got to be some black writers out there. Well, how? And they had 3,000 entries, so you know they had me running. I spent the whole $1,000 on computers, on just all types of things. The first computer I didn't even use. I just went crazy, and I joined the writers group, and so I've been in a writer's group since 92, and I'm in another one. I'm in two now. So, I mean, it's just been a slow journey. And like I said, when I'm going to get a break. But now, then I found, wait a minute, we're all counting on Obama to fix things that were messed up way before he got in office.
Yeah.
We got the white people coming at him, attacking him. Then we got black people coming at him, attacking him. But nobody said a thing. He's doing the best he could. Some people didn't have jobs for years anyway. And I'm out here in Southern California, and I've seen the proactiveness of Latinos who cannot even speak English. One just came and fixed my roof. His boss tried to give me a big price. He came afterwards, after work, and did the smaller job, which is all I needed was a patching. And I said, that's what business is. It's not about some big fax machine, computer. It's just that you provide a service that people need, and that's what started happening. Once I found the internet in 98, I had left my job in 97, October 97, and the internet, I think I got on it like the end of 98, December 98, and my first thing I ran was a contest, and this girl said, oh, Maxine, you run a contest, you can just get hundreds of thousands. Well, you know, it just because you put up a website, that doesn't draw the people.
No, you said that right.
Right. You got to kind of first give away some things to get people to come. But the irony is the very thing, okay, so I just put up an editorial service. I didn't think I could do it. I had worked at a publishing company, Dr. Milligan's, Milligan Books at that time. Publishing company for 6 months where I formatted books and typeset some, and I hadn't learned to edit yet. And so I just put up an editorial service, and Baba Evans was my first customer. I mean, he contacted me within a month, and it was like a fluke, and I think a lot of businesses are flukes. You just, and that became, and like this month I noticed it was about 7 writers that I edited last year that are all black expressions. I noticed Brenda Hampton's Naughty 2, which I had done, and just a lot of different ones, Keisha Irwin, Guns and Roses. And I said, wow, but that was just, you know, but it's because I've already had all this life experience, 23 years as a social worker. I'm a grandmother, you know, I've raised children, I've been through the whole ball of wax. And so this is why it was time. Everything is in God's time. It was in divine order now that I would be able to not, like I have a caller that listens to my show. He said, well, why did you give that editor all the credit? I said, you know, I haven't had any problem with sharing other people's gifts with anybody. And that's how you get out. We think, I've known some writers who, when we started out, they wouldn't share any information. They wouldn't tell you anything. They would even call you and say, I'm going to give you a list of book club. I see these writers are not as well known because you get known by what you give, not by what you take.
Wow, Maxine, that's a good point. But there's a part of a lot of, I think, us that we have to learn to overcome it as humans. We think just the opposite. And then you learn that it is in the giving and in trying, like you said, filling a service or a gap there, that that's where your business really starts to grow, or whatever you're doing, like being an editor, writers start to come to you. I wanted to ask you, and you had mentioned this briefly, the movie that's out now, Precious. I know you worked for 23 years, and that's an awful long time, and the work that you did, I can only just imagine. I worked very briefly. We had this book bag volunteer program where I used to work, and I saw people who were involved in that environment, and oh my goodness, the way some of the children, the things that they go through, and the dysfunction in some of the families. I thank you for what you did. You know, as a social worker in California, I had thought about being a social worker years ago, but I said, I don't know if I want to go down that road. But I wanted to ask you about the new movie Precious that's out. It's being, you know, produced by Tyler Perry and Oprah Winfrey. Was based on Sapphire's book Push. With your experience as a social worker, and to our listeners who've never read Maxine Thompson's work, I tell you, any book you pick up, she's written a short story. Her talent just comes blaring through. You are so talented. I wanted to ask you, had you ever thought about taking your experiences, things you learned, not like actually as a nonfiction account of something, not to do it that way, to enter any legal grounds, but had you ever thought about taking your experiences as a social worker and writing a book, not just like Precious, but something in that along those lines?
Yes, the one I just did. Well, my sister-in-law used to say, Maxine, you need to write a book about how to do social work and keep on top of it like you did. You know how I could go to court in one hearing. I would write a short report, and the judge couldn't find holes to pick in it. It would be short to the point. And after a while, there were people who were MSWs, masters in social work. They would write these long reports, keep getting continuous, tied all up in the system. That was my last 3 years as a dependency investigator versus being in the field. I was in the field in Detroit for 7 years because I'm born and raised. I'm a Motown. I'm a Midwesterner by spirit and heart. I'm really not a California-born person. But the book I just wrote and turned in September 30th, is called L.A. Blues, and it's actually, I stepped inside. I always worried what happened to all these young girls that I work with, similar to probably how she felt. And I chose a child that I could relate to in one way. For 1 year, I lived with a white family, and I had that book written when I was 16, but I need to go back and write it from an adult perspective. But it was given too much credit to the white woman, and not to my mother. So I'm so glad that when I did write my first book, it was about my mother who shaped me versus trying to. But you know, this lady, I have to give her credit. Her name is Verna Barkner. She is she's still living. And I talked to her about a year ago. She's 78 now, but she was an artist, and she told me, Maxine, I see great things in you. And here I was, real ghetto, you know. Oh, what you talking about? I ain't trying to. And then I just had, you know. So she was a sculptress, and she even got my story over to Reader's Digest. But I wasn't able at that point. And I'm glad when I see how young people get big and sabotage. I'm so glad, you know, that I'm, because you never hear about people like Maya Angelou, Toni Morrison, because they were over 40 when they got out into this industry.
Oh, Maya Angelou, years. Oh,
right?
You kidding?
But they were a good age when they started. And so I'm glad I was in my 40s when my writing career finally took off. But this was something that was there when I was young. And I think, you know, kind of, it's too much too soon sometimes. And a lot of writers who started young, they died young. Carson McCullough, you know, The Heart is a Lonely Hunter. So I'm kind of glad that life for me kind of started later when I could really appreciate it and enjoy it. But this lady, the girl I wrote, her name is Z. The book is L.A. Blues. Hopefully it'll come out next year through Urban Books. And it's where she was the child of a Crip. Now, the Crips, a female Crip, not a male Crip, female. I found out there were female Crips, too. I was watching some specials. And so she was raised half her life with her mother, and after a family tragedy, murder, she had to go into foster care. She was raised in Baldwin Hills, which is like the Beverly Hills of the black community here in Los Angeles. And that was, and see, I could relate to that because of that 1 year experience. It made me see how people who had cottages went skiing. It made me want more, and as a result, I've owned two homes. But this child had demons. She becomes a police, and it's a love story between her and this Latino guy who's also from a gang family. You know, and it was also the underlying theme is the wholesale murder of young African Americans. No one's saying anything. Males here in L.A. Mm-hmm. And also the kind of growing war between the Latinos and the blacks. They have it in prison all the time. Now they have them in all types of gang fights. And some of it's over drugs, and some of it's because of the economy. And when two minorities, I mean, not even minorities, the Latinos are becoming a really large population. I think half of the United States now.
Right.
But there's a lot of gang fights now that used to be among the blacks. Now it's among the blacks and the Latinos. So I say we used to be a people that got along. And nobody's mm-hmm. wanting to talk about that. So, you know, I have that kind of conflict. And then the West Side Story, Romeo and Juliet thing. And I want it to be a series. She becomes a private eye after she's a police. But her childhood, I'm telling it in first person like Precious, I wouldn't have been able to speak in that voice had I not been a social worker. But I wasn't able to do this years earlier. I just learned first person. I would say in the last 3 or 4 years I start writing first person.
I think that's a powerful voice to write in, except it, some people say it can be limiting. If the character can hold that story by themselves for the most part, I mean, there are other characters in the book, but everything's seen through this one person's eyes, then first person really it can really connect the reader to the story very, very deeply. I want to talk a little bit about each of your books, and I'm, of course, going to start with The Ebony Tree, which I keep saying is a classic because to me it is. I wanted to ask you, why didn't the mother in the story, and I know you alluded to it earlier, and it's interesting that you took that point, raising our daughters, but not really to be grown women, but raising our sons mainly to be good sons to the mother, but why didn't the mother in The Ebony Tree, Jewel, why didn't she, after what she had been through, and I know what you're saying about the slavery and the being sold off, why didn't she offer more understanding to her own daughter, particularly as her daughter got older, because she was Grace was a good girl. She was responsible. She helped take care of her siblings. I was just, that part of the book irritated me. I mean, I love this story as a whole. Why didn't she offer more understanding to her daughter as she got older?
Well, she was young. When she got older, she really treated her better. And I guess they might even need a sequel to that. That's my older sister who just passed. And she had to carry the role of the older girl. Almost everybody I know that's the oldest in a family is 6 or 7. They washed, they cooked, they did everything, and they lost their childhood. So what happened when my sister became grown? She became a free spirit. She really, my mother ended up having to semi-help raise her daughter. It was just a lot of things. My sister got her childhood back, and my mother was more understanding because she realized, and they were even closer, it seemed like, when my mother died than my mother and I. But I was just kind of sheltered because I was the youngest of the first six. I didn't do a thing but lay around. She wanted to make sure I had my books, feet up. I did just enough to get by. I wasn't, so I had my childhood versus my sister being it was like two boys and a girl, then two boys and a girl. So my sister, when she died, it was like losing my mother all over. I was at her deathbed. I stayed with her for 2 weeks. I slept on the floor. I tried to fight off death. I did everything. And later it hit me. I said, she is just as much was like your mother. Your memories of her. I mean, you can imagine a 7-year-old got a baby on her hip walking. You had to do
at the start of the at the opening of The Ebony Tree. You can see little Grace. And I know when my mom passed when I was 7, I took on a lot of grown woman responsibilities looking after my siblings. So I connected with Grace and wondering why is her mom. Look at all she's putting on her, and it's like she knew, but she didn't know, and she needed the help. And then when Grace, this girl is so bright so bright, so responsible, so strong. And then she grows up and makes some of these huge mistakes as a grown woman. I'm like, how in the world could she make these mistakes? She was so bright as a child. I mean, this book was just, it brought up so many emotions in me. I just love this book, and you do such a good job with these complicated relationships.
And later, you know, what my mother tried to do, she tried to, like, she was real big on having family dinners. Up until she died, she was cooking for everyone, and she did a lot to keep family together. She was like the anchor. When she died, we kind of lost that, and plus we had all moved to different states. Not all. There were about four that still remained in Detroit. But it was, you know, her mother had left her with the relatives because of the Depression. So she didn't even have a bond with her mother at all. So she didn't know how to be a mother to a girl. But she learned by the time she got to me, she had relaxed. But it was that anger, and she just loved her boys. She favored her boys, but that was how, all she had seen. Boys were really valued in the Black family, at least in ours, because they were seen as the ones who could take care of you when you got older, and a girl was just seen as a split tail, that she didn't have no value back then. Women didn't basically have careers and could bring money to the table, but the boys, they just raised you to be a wife. Even I was kind of raised with that mentality, to be a wife or secretary. But they raised the boys with that possibility, not maybe to be a president, but as a Black man back in the 50s, but that they could be more. They were given cars to drive. So that was where that dynamic. She had issues with her mother, and then my sister pointed out something, that this thing had been handed down through our family. And I've had that issue with my oldest daughter, and I didn't raise her, and that's kind of what Hostage of Lies is about. And so it's like this history and breaking the cycle. Somebody got to break the cycle. I've kind of broken it now with both of my daughters.
Oh, that's good. You know, I'm listening to you, Maxine, and I'm sure many of our listeners here off the shelf can as well relate, but I'm thinking about my grandmother, and she said that when she was a young girl, my grandma was born like in 1921. She's passed on, but she said if you were a boy, it was like, whoa, man. If you were a girl, it was almost like, I had a girl. It was no big deal. But the boys, she said, they were really.
Born in 21. So you see, that was the same generation.
Yeah. And so she said, she saw it, and she got it from her mother. You know, the boys were just treated differently than the girls. And that's just the way things went back then, which is, I just find it peculiar. But not all cultures do that. And I'm not sure if the African culture does that, but I'm not sure if all regions of Africa and all the different communities in the continent, if they all, you know, react that way to the different genders. But it's come from somewhere.
Oh, this is worldwide, from the Bible. Look, China, they would lead the girl baby out. Remember the Good Earth Pearl book? How they would lead the girl baby out on the thing to die. I mean, before they had the one-child law, it was the many girl babies that were killed and slaughtered. And this is around the world. Until recently, I was reading something where a writer had done a study of literature. That was men were the only writers, and that was the underlying question. What are we to do with the woman problem? We were like the slave. Okay, so Color Purple dealt with the double whammy, being female and being Black. Because see how Mr. was like the king up in that house, and Cecil said, I may be a woman, I may be Black. Those were, and then I never forgot Sophie, who Oprah played so beautifully. She said, a girl child ain't safe in a house full of boys. And see, look at Precious, Push. So all this stuff is just coming out of because we used to have a myth, even as a social worker, there was a myth that African Americans did not molest their children. That's a lie. It's a
quote. Oh, yeah. I think a lot of people still believe that, and you're right, it is a lie. It is a lie. I wanted to ask you if you could just tell our readers here at Off the Shelf about your other book, No Pockets in the Shroud. Just give them a little background on No Pockets in the Shroud.
Well, actually, it's Hostage of Lies now, and I'm trying to get them to take it off of Amazon, but they have booksellers that sell used copies now. And the Hostage of Lies, okay, now this is the more updated version. It's a little better. I think it's better written because I'm an editor now, and that's been 10 years of editing, and then the editing I got from Martha Weber was just excellent, and it just made it a better book, you know, cliffhangers, it made the pacing pick up, but it's about a search for wholeness and also an adoption search. The main character is looking for her daughter. I wrote it before I found my daughter. I had a 12-year adoption search for my own daughter, who I had real young, and my mother was trying to break this cycle of young, because my sister had a baby young, so she raised that one, but in my case, she said no. And I'm looking back as an older woman now, I'm 58, I understand now. My mother saw the potential in me, and back then, having a child, your life was ruined. Period. Simple than that. Just it was not like now. You can go to school, even though girls don't go half of them. They can, you know, but you didn't have all the support system, and you were ostracized. So,
yeah.
I would have been looking for my child for 12 years from the time she turned 18. And fortunately, I found her alive. She's with good people, family, and I've been with her since she had her two children. So, you know, it's, and we've got a going on 13-year relationship. But I wrote this before I found her, and that's how I believe in the power of the word to call. Like, remember in the Bible, it says, in the beginning there was the word, and he spoke life into existence. God spoke it into existence. Well, that's what I wrote the book where she found the child at the end. Well, the child found her in that version, but in real life I did the finding. But I finished writing my book March of 1997, and then I find her on April 30th, got a call. It's a girl. And
oh, my goodness.
Yes, and so we're going on our 13th anniversary.
Wow. Friday.
But so the book has that, but the rest is goes way back into slavery and stories different foster parents told me and stories that twisted some of you, like the Trail of Tears that was told to me from my father. And, I made a story, and this is before I knew about the hero's journey, Joseph Campbell, that I use a lot of archetypes and structural things for editing books now, but I just wrote it intuitively and following my spirit. And I was listening to the ancestors, and in the new version, I even have the opening. I mean, I have the quote from because I said there's a connection in even giving a child up for adoption. If you're black, that's why we saw so many families that kept children in the family, even if the girl was 10 or 12. So I have born 13 children and seen most all sold off to slavery. And when I cried with my mother's grief, none but Jesus heard me. And ain't I a woman, Sojourner Truth? And, I mean, I had this sorrow inside of me, and a lot of birth mothers will go into social work. After I found her, my sister said, you won't even work as a social worker no more because now you felt that need and that guilt. So, you know, and generally I don't always open up on the show and tell where the root of the story came from, but when I had to put the edits in, I hadn't read the book in years. And
wow.
It was so painful. My fingers hurt just putting it in. So that pain is still there, but it's been healed by the reunion, you know.
Oh, my goodness. So, to our listening, and we had our guest last week. She actually dealt with a subject, but it was more of losing a child, through the transition. But this is, and then to hear you say this, this is amazing. We could have listeners who need to hear this. I know at the Barnes & Noble has this posted at their website about Hostage of Lies. It says, imagine Nefertiti absent from her family because of her imagined shame. She returns only to find that she was the only one who didn't have a reason to be ashamed. And I know shame is a part of a lot of people's lives and things that we like to keep hidden and don't want other people to know about. I wanted to ask you, why did you choose to address this really power-packed emotion that at some point most of us as humans, particularly as adults, maybe all of us have to deal with? Why did you choose to address this shame so openly and Hostage of Lies?
At the end, I always ask writers when I'm editing now, I say, what did they learn from the journey? What is the lesson? And I put, the truth will set you free. Finding my daughter has been so freeing. All this work, I've done it since I found her. I might could have done it earlier, but I had this shame inside of me that I had a child and didn't know where she was. And I could relate to how slave mothers must have felt having their kids sold away. I had three other children. I'm married, still married to the same man. And I was, you know, quote unquote, sanctioned by society when those were born. And I loved them dearly. I probably loved them more in another way. And I gave them the type of attention that I'm glad. Maybe that's what kept me through the hard times because I was out here with no family. The second half of my oldest son was with me. He was 9 when we moved here. One was 3 months, and my daughter was 5. And each year, like he called me not too long ago to say how one of his friend's mother, who had several boyfriends live with her, he said, your mother was always professional. And I look back, I don't think I was, you know, as an older woman, you always look back and say, oh, I could have did better, but I did best I could with what I knew. But I was one thing I was not invested in them. They were involved in a lot of activities, which after I worked all day, I had to run. And everything is way out. Like, sometimes it's 2 hours to get to cheerleading practice if we took the streets. And
mm-hmm.
2 hours, one might be in one game down in Orange County, one up in the San Fernando Valley, and then I'd be driving 2 hours or an hour on the freeway between trying to make second half of one. But that was the type of commitment, because I know what it was not to have had a child. And it's kind of like you try to find redemption. But I really kind of, it was something when I wrote the book, and I felt like the ancestors led me in that book. And I had so many spiritual experiences. Finding my daughter was one of the highlights of my life. Now, she's been something to deal with. You know, we've gone through the whole shebang. It hasn't been no piece of cake. And I took, I read a lot of books before I found her, and one of them was saying that you sometimes have to come to a point of a break. We kind of had that since my sister's death, and we talked recently, and it was like a coming back together where I think she can appreciate me, and I appreciated her. We needed a little break here because I'm also a caregiver for my husband, and I had major surgery. I just couldn't take her, and it was really, you know, it was really that she needed to have an appreciation, and I have one. Like my sister said, she's going to appreciate all, not just the material things, but the wisdom. I bring a history that goes back to 1825, you know, a family tree that she didn't know. She had no family tree.
Mm-hmm. Wow. And, Maxine. Oh,
she has, now she has her sisters. Like when me and her weren't speaking, she's got a sister. She's got three through me, and then through her father is one. And, you know, and she gives me a lot of insight into the hip-hop language, because even though she's younger than me, she as things she says, and she has kind of a writer's mind. My sister says she's probably a greater writer than I ever was once she gets through all the different issues she has to go through from being adopted. But she had a great family. It's just adoptees are going to have issues.
Okay.
And I had to accept, I had an unrealistic expectation of what, but you know what? Now I'm real with it, and we're human, and I'm so glad that she will always know where I am. I don't know, like I told her when I found her, this is till I die or you die.
I think that's amazing, and I'm so glad to hear that the two of you did come together. And it's your stories, what you write, and maybe this is true of all writers. I do believe bits and pieces of our own lives find their way into our the stories that we write. They don't only help the readers who find a connection with what a particular author writes, but I think they also help the author themselves to work through things. And I think you're just another proof of that. I want to talk a little bit about so many things you do. You're an editor, you're a literary agent, you're a writer yourself. I wanted to ask you, for literary agent, you know, we often hear that a writer cannot get published today without a literary agent. That being said, Maxine, what would you say are three of the most critical things that writers should look for before they sign a contract with a literary agent? Because not all literary agents are legit. What are the top three things writers should look for in a literary agent?
Well, you shouldn't have to pay for a reading fee. Now, I separate my literary editorial services from my agency. I work for free until you get a contract, and if you never get one, I never get paid, and that's just work I did. That's why I'm trying to be more selective as to who I pick. But, you know, that was the learning curve I had to go through.
Mm-hmm.
And if I did shape or tell a writer something as an agent, you know, there's no charge for that. So you shouldn't pay your agent. You want an agent that's reputable, that's going to pay you your money, that you get it, you know, within a reasonable time, no bounce checks, because the check does go to them. Now, these are things I've learned from the business, and I haven't had that problem, and I was told I have a good reputation. And I'm just feeling, I'm beginning to hear from people all the time that want me to be the agent, but it's just overwhelming. So I found someone that's a new agent, and I'm going to try to just, if I can't do it and I think the book has potential, I'll give it to this other agent. And that's Brenda Hampton, for those listening that might want to try her services, because I feel there's enough for everybody. I just can't do it all. One person can't do it all. And my mission is that we all need a voice, and my business motto is, if you don't write it down, it didn't happen. You didn't happen. That's why, as African-American, that was the job motto. As a social worker, they would look in your case if something that blew up over the weekend, which it was wont to do, and every day I always had the most volatile caseload. If you didn't have something written down, you were in bad shape. You were kicked to the curb, fired. But so I learned the habit of writing things down real fast, and I've started writing. I'm supposed to start writing for Harlem World and also for the Queens Book Fair, which is part of CMB Book Distribution.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, I used to write for Booking Matters for 5 years. You know, they're offline. I think they're going online now. But
okay.
I found the deadlines made me write. I also decided to go back to doing book reviews because I used to do them. I have one I did on Terry McMillan's book back in 2000 on bookreporter.com. I still have it on my website, but I said we need to go back to having good book reviews because Kirkus have gone out of business and there's a need for book reviewers. And I want to go back to reading for enjoyment again instead
yeah.
of just reading for work and editing or being an agent.
What can you just let our listeners get off the shelf know briefly, what's a day in the life of a literary agent like? You don't hear too much about it. The main thing people hear about literary agents for our listeners is that they sell books to publishers, but what would you say are some of the things literary agents do during the day to support their clients?
Well, I answer a lot through emails, but I also talk on the phone. I have conferences. I have writers. It's just something I stumbled on. I had writers just like Write It Down, Make It Happen was one of the books I read since I've been in business. And that happened looking back with finding my daughter. Well, the same thing with my writers. I have them write down all the books that they want to write. And one of them, Michelle McGriff, had written me a lot. And now she has 15 book deals. And
whoa.
The titles have been written. And she got the 15 book deals in 3 years.
Wow.
And every writer that comes to me, I have them write down a list of what they want to write and all their aspirations and goals. And some of the things, sometimes when they're really depressed about the checks being late, we all commiserate together. Look, when you hold each other's hands. And so it's sort of like social work in the and then I have a day I like to make calls Thursday because Monday I believe is a meeting day and Friday. And sometimes I catch people on Friday. I don't do it. I kind of try to follow this spiritual thing of when it feels right, then make the move because what's for you tends to come to you. If it's not for you, if I get a rejection, I don't take it personally. I mean it just wasn't for you. So then I soften it and let the writers know it's not them. If I believe in their work, it's just we haven't found the right publisher. It's a marriage between the publisher and the writer.
Wow, Maxine, I'm so glad you said that. And this comes with experience. You've gotten out there and gotten some living under your belt. A lot of people say it comes with time. I don't agree that it just comes with time. I think also experience. You got to get some life experiences under your belt, which you definitely have. And it comes through in your voice and in your spirit. And that's how you know. Don't fight things or don't try to force things. I might not say that all the time. Don't fight it. Don't force it. And you just learn that what is for you will come rather naturally. You won't have to push. Maxine, I wanted to ask you, as a writer and a literary agent, you're kind of wearing a dual role there. How is that challenging for you to wear that, to be the writer who's also you're trying to get your own book sold? And I know you work with, I think it was, you said Urban Books. And then you're also working to sell your clients' work. Is that challenging for you at times, or have you found a way to do that with ease?
I'm doing right now. What I do is focus. One reason my books stop selling is I stop pushing. I notice there's a direct correlation between how much you push and how much sales is in the book marketing area.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I slowed up as I built my radio show starting in 2002. I stopped pushing my books, and then I was making it with my editing. And then when I started my literary agent in 2003, I didn't get my first book deal to 2005 when I threw my hands up and said, forget this. It was September. I got 8-1. And so that's what I'm saying. When it's time, and then, like, I remember when this book, No Pockets, came out, and I sold about 500 to friends and work and this and that. no movement. My sister-in-law said, the very one that is always, I call her my main cheerleader. She's also my best friend because we were friends before she married my brother. But she said, you know what, when it's time, so now I found out Hostage of Lies was book of the month on book stand.
Wow. Oh,
and
my goodness.
On a big blast, on the first page of this Black Expression email that just went out. And then you're telling me it was at Barnes and Nobles with that size. So that makes me feel good. But look how long a journey has been, 12 years. There was no overnight anything. So a lot of us, I mean, look at Steve Harvey. He's been out there about 15, 20 years as a
right.
comedian, and he had the radio show. So he built a platform. That's my recommendation. Build a platform, the internet radio. Looking back, I didn't see it at the time. I just intuitively sensed that it would position me in a way, and I didn't know how. Now I put on my website, she has used that out of the box, and it wasn't out of the box. It just fell in my lap. People called me, and that's how I got it. You know, so just be ready and see. Some things you can plan, but the most exciting things are not the things you plan. It's what God got for you. And somehow he'll put the people in your life that you need to do what you have to do. But from there, I met Carl Weber, and, you know, he's become, really, he's my one of my main clients as far as I edit. You know, I just started that a year ago doing, because I used to just do freelance. Now and then I would get a job from him, but now I do, you know, content edit, as, and that's more steady, and so it's making me where I don't have to just take any job that comes from freelance, because sometimes the people have been a headache. I've had a few outside clients this year that were really good, but I've had, you know, some really bad experiences where the
mm-hmm.
writers were really bad, but that's what I started out. I started out with the worst of the worst writers, where I almost had to rewrite their books, which taught me how to ghostwrite.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know how
I focus on one thing, so now I'm kind of focusing on my promoting of my book, and I can kind of feel a sense of, but I'm planning on, I have some people I plan, I sent out 10 books the first in September, got a lot of rejections because right now the market is bad, but I'm sending out something about a bunch of it in January after everybody gets back from the holiday, and I still got 3 or 4 that's still out there waiting for answers, and I'm getting ready to start trying to get some movie deals. But what I find is focus, the power of focus. You focus on that one area, put all your energies in one thing. Don't try to scatter your energies.
I would agree with that. I think because if you focus, I agree, is a key. If you want to tackle a lot of different things at once, then you need a team. And you have a team that focus on, like, social media. One person on that team focus on that, or 1 to 3 people. You build a team of people to do different things. But one person cannot do, I don't think, 10, 15 things well. So, again,
right.
Focus. Think about what your priorities are. If you still want to broaden and do a lot of things, then you might need to, at that point, start to build a team, and then you can take on more. Maxine, being an editor, and I, you know, I've worked with editors more, so as a freelance writer, and have a wonderful editor in California who now edits my books. But I wanted to ask you, I hear a lot of people, writers and editors, say, and it's odd how they work together, and you're both a writer and an editor, but writers are very sensitive people, tell me, that to tell a writer, I don't care how gracefully you do it, that there's proof in a story, that writers don't always take that so gently. Would you agree that writers are very sensitive about their work, and they don't like to receive feedback unless it's positive? And if this is true, what can we as writers do to become more open to constructive feedback? Because that makes our stories that much better.
Oh, yes. Don't do anything the first time you read the editor's notes. Calm down and start working on it. I know people get mad at my notes, but then what I try to do, I'll put the strengths, you know, I'll get my overall impression, which I'll give you something good, then I'll put the strengths, then the weaknesses, and then the suggestions. So I kind of come at it that way, because when I open my editorial notes for Hostage of Life, I said, and I just wrote her back. I said, I see how my work cut out for me. And you know, but I had to step away. I had to get into my editor mode. I said,
yeah.
Okay. And just take this one thing at a time, each one. And then as I went into the book editing, it hurt on my fingers. It was just, even just putting the edits in, because I hadn't realized how much painful stuff I had written. And even with the 12 years, and I'm thinking I'm healed, It hurt, but it was a little more distance. So I said, maybe this is what I had to be more distance where I could really even shape the book where I explained a lot of stuff where a reader could understand it even better.
Mm-hmm.
But that strong edit, when I first saw it, I said, my goodness. But, you know, she did start out with the sweet, with the sweetness. This book has the potential to
be. She fetch you down the road.
Did 302 edits, my God.
Oh, my gosh.
But
oh
it's
my
so
goodness.
Much better for it. So
uh-huh.
Be glad if you got an editor with a good eye for detail and catching mm-hmm. all your inconsistencies. Because, you know, you have your general story you know you want to tell, but you cannot see it. And Carl Weber made the remark to me, what makes a bestseller? Well, he didn't say that. He said, what makes a good writer? A good editor.
Yes, I would agree. I would agree because as a writer, you can't catch it all. You know the gist of the story, but a full-length novel, even a short story in some cases, but more so a novel, I think we do need an editor or somebody else with a really good, trained, sharp eye to look at it. I want to let our listeners here at Off the Shelf know that Maxine's website is www.maxinethompson, and spelled how it sounds, M-A-X-I-N-E. THOMPSON.com. Again, that's www.maxinethompson.com. Maxine Thompson is an editor. She's an author. She's a literary agent. And she's a woman who's 23 years in social work. Her new book is Hostage of Lies. And I encourage you to get that. And I also encourage our listeners to get The Ebony Tree. Everything I've read that Maxine has written, I have been, oh, my goodness, I don't know if you're aware of your talent. It's just, I put you up there with the best of writers. I read a short story that you wrote. It was in a compilation of books, and I can't remember the other authors exactly, their names, who were also in there, but it seemed like it was two or three other authors
right.
who had stories. It was a romance book that came out maybe 4 or 5 years ago.
No, it was going on three. That was Secret Lovers, and my story was Second Chances, where
this woman
got shot up. She had her small business, and during that time, we were seeing a lot of employee violence, and we're going to see more, unfortunately, because of the economy. But she got shot up, and this was about your life being destroyed, and how do you put it back together? Husband left her to show that you can still sometimes find love. And then never knew love, I used Katrina. I had a man over in Louisiana who caught his wife in bed, and I had a woman in L.A. who was an attorney who got stood up at the altar. And somehow between this horrible event, Katrina, their lives, and they don't even meet to page 50, their lives intertwine. And the lesson she had to learn is that I am connected to my people. She had really disengaged herself. She grew up in South Central, and she had made it, and she couldn't stand her black relatives. And she felt better than everybody. And so she had a dream similar to Scrooge, except it took her all the way back to the Middle Passage. And she realized, I am connected to my people. And so she opened her home and took in this family, and that's how she met the male character. So that one was, and then I did one with a small company called All in the Family, where I did the sister that was, what do they call it? When you're the person that gives the some director, where you get the roles for the actors. And I had that sister having to learn where she had gone wrong, separating herself from her Southern roots and feeling like her mother hated her. It turned out her mother had risked her life for her when she was pregnant. So she, I try to show stories where people go through great character transformations,
mm-hmm.
and I try to write stories that take risks that hurt me just even to write them. And I read once that Toni Morrison said, if your guts turn or something to that degree, if you feel it in your soul, like that's what you need to be writing, stuff that we feel like. I think that's why Push is so good and the movie Press is because it's just so gritty and it just, but it's stuff we need to deal with.
Yes, yes. Yeah, I would agree. I read Second Chances, and it's your writing, your style of writing, and you're very good with characters. I truly love that short story. You started out with poetry, you've written short story, and you've written full-length novels. How do you make that shift? Because I think writing a short story is very different than writing a novel. How do you make that shift, and you do it so well? How do you do that? Do you do anything special, or does that just come natural to you?
No, well, it was my time frames. The short story, the poetry, because I had three kids, and the youngest was a baby. Then the short stories, the one that I got the money from Ebony, he was six. The light was getting a little brighter. You know, half of your brain goes out with those children. But if it wasn't for my children, I wouldn't have the depth and emotions and range of writing that I would have had, I believe. You know, all of the messiness of life that you go through, rushing to work, trying to get babysitting and all this. That is what made me and made me better as a writer, you know, where I can be human and see our mistakes and our flaws, our vulnerabilities, and our strengths in spite of all the craziness. And that's what makes for good movies, where they just show the messiness of life, but yet you recognize it. Yet somehow we get through, we rise above it, and we overcome. And so I try to write about characters that overcome, because the one in Second Chances, she had to overcome. She had to learn to walk again.
Yes. Yeah.
And I love the love story of a healing man, because I was getting sick of the books I was working on was showing all the bad boy guys. I said, how about the good guys? The kind that was sick by you when you had breast cancer. The kind that helped this strange woman come back from the brink of death, because she had actually been pronounced dead. What gave me that idea was I was in the hairdresser. As writers, we have great eavesdroppers, or we just listen for stories where the woman said that this woman had been pronounced dead, and they had a man on the gurney in the back, and her fingers went to moving in. Because sometimes it happens, so I had that happen to the character.
Oh, okay. Wow. I want to ask you again, we only have 8 minutes left, and I want to make sure our listeners here at Off the Shelf get some tips for those who are writers. I wanted to ask you, what are some of the best ways then I want to also ask you about some things, upcoming events that you might be appearing at so our listeners can support you. But what are some of the best ways you would say, with just 8 minutes left, that steps writers can take to land a literary agent?
Sharpen your axe. Become good at the craft. Read books on the craft. One of the ones that have helped me as an editor is Donald Moss. He's also a literary agent. His book, Writing the Breakout Novel, and read some of the books that he refers to in that book. He looked at all the books. One of them was These Lovely Bones, which I saw where they're making the movie. I saw it on HBO, showing how they're making the movie from it now. And that was a debut novel. But he compared, like, Mystic River and different books, and he gives little quotes from them. He said these were books that, in spite of a bad economy, they broke out from and became New York Times bestsellers, and he analyzed what were some of the things that these books did. And one of them was an inner journey. I hate to say some of our books now are moving so fast, they're not showing any inner reflection, any epiphanies, any revelation, any moments of truth, or inner as well as the outer journey. Have a character that's kind of heroic, not Superman, but heroic, where they take action. Don't have a passive sitting back. Not doing nothing. Even if they mess up, let them take action. You know, he just compared what were some of these things. So I looked for that in the books. And when I saw that several other books, and I've got to even look through the list that I've worked on in this last year from Urban. But when I saw that they were on Black Expressions Book Club, I said, well, then that's helping. You know, just asking the writer, what was the lesson? What regrets did they have? And then I read a recent article by get the writers and the Writer's Digest, but this one I loved. It was in September 2009, Writer's Digest, I believe. And it was where Donald Moss was talking about he's getting tired as an agent of not seeing fire and passion. Write about what you're passionate about. When I said the mother, I was passionate about finding my child. I was passionate about my mother who had died and wanting to see that her life was not in vain and examining her life. I was passionate about, even when I wrote that one, it was just inspired by a TV special where the woman had been shot down and she was the only survivor. So, well, how do you deal with survivor guilt? They say people who survive a plane crash and everybody else, they have survivor guilt. Mm-hmm. And then the one in Katrina, of course, I was very passionate when I watched. Here we're in the richest country in the world, compared where we used to be. But anyway, yeah, we run around here when I cook too, but that when I saw what happened to my people in Katrina, I said, I want to memorialize this just as they do the Holocaust. It was a Holocaust right here under our nose, and the media even captured it in film. And then I had watched Spike Lee say, so I did a lot of research for it. And then for this book that I did, L.A. Blues, I'm really upset over the blood running in the street. Nobody saying a thing. And plus, we lost my husband's 18-year-old nephew was killed that summer. I think I'm going to dedicate the book to him. And to the loss of all this young life, that's like eight generations wiped out when a young black male. And so I'm just really bad. And then also it was a tribute kind of to the foster kids that I have worked with through the years, because it's a shame. So many of our kids have, it's a whole different lifestyle. And I have some molestation that went on, not with my main character, with her foster sister. But it's just so many kids, adults that are scarred now that had to grow up like that. But I gave her a good foster home so that there was more of a stability there because of, and her life was better for having been. And I think we all have to learn that spiritually we choose our parents, and that we go to them for the life lessons we have to learn, no matter how bad and painful they are. I kind of picked that up when I reread Push this time. The thing was, just like at the end of Beloved, where Paul D. told Seth, you your best thing. We all have to learn wholeness. We all have to learn self-acceptance and self-love. And that's what I saw in Push when I reread it this time. And that was kind of, I'm hoping, my message in L.A. Blues and in Hostage of Lies. And even then, there's still another secret I'm not even going to reveal that she doesn't know, to show that some things we don't know. And from the older generation, they knew how to take their secrets to the grave.
Oh, yes. Oh, ooh. We have 3 minutes left. We are talking to Maxine Thompson, and please visit her online. She's at www.maxinethompson.com, spelled just the way it sounds, MaxineThompson. Again, that's www.maxinethompson.com. She's a literary agent. She has landed a contract for her author clients with mainstream book publishers. She's on Black Expressions, the largest African-American book club in the United States. She's also an editor, and, of course, she's a writer herself, poet, short story writing, novel writing, and she has told us on this interview she's now thinking about, you know, trying to get some movie deals going. We only have 2 minutes left, Maxine. I just want to let our listeners here at Off the Shelf know, again, if you want to contact Maxine, go to her website, www.maxinethompson.com. She's the author of The Ebony Tree, Hostage of Lies. She has written short stories, Second Chances, I read. She is just a phenomenal woman and an extremely talented writer. You think of the best authors out there, the Gloria Naylors, the Alice Walkers. Maxine is equally as talented in my eyes from her work that I have read. With only 2 minutes left, Maxine, I wanted to ask you, what last words of encouragement or advice would you like to leave with our listeners here at Off the Shelf?
Well, the one thing is to keep writing, and when the economy breaks, you might have 10 books in the hop and self-publish. You have print-on-demand now where you can do it for about $1,000 through Lightning Source. I understand you can even get a 30%, do blog tours, which are really helpful. And with the blog tours, you can, I read where the man who wrote the 4-Hour Work Week, I think that he made the New York Times without one book signing. He did blog tours. A lot of bookstores have been closed here in Los Angeles for black writers, and that's why I'm saying get familiar with the Internet, do the blog tours. I just started blogging, and I watch my Google numbers go up. This is the most opportune time in history to be a writer and to be a black writer particularly. And the reason I do what I do is when I was a child, there were no black books in the library except for one. I scoured the library to find a book, so I said I never want another little black girl growing up like I did. We used to play white because we were so excluded from this society. All we saw were white people on TV, and we even dreamed in white and everything else. So I noticed my children grew up with black literature, and my daughter has a real high self-esteem, my youngest daughter, from that. And it's just important for people to read books So it's also, not only are you writing for yourself, you're writing for culture, and I do believe books are the repository of our culture. You want to have something left for people.
Thank you so much to Maxine and for all her advice and insight and sharing very deep things about even herself and her book. You can see it in Hostage of Lies and The Ebony Tree and other books that she has written. We want to thank Maxine for being here with us. Please visit her online at www.maxinethompson.com. And please be sure to visit me at my website, www.chistell.com. Come back next week at 11 o'clock, the same time Saturday, December the 26th at 11 a.m. We'll have bringing another guest to you, Michael Marklin, who is also an author, to share his advice with you. We will continue to bring you authors and editors and literary agents and other movers and shakers in the book industry. Please, those of you in Philadelphia, travel safely through the snow. Those of you in the West Coast, enjoy the warm sunshine. Thanks again to Maxine Thompson, to all our listeners. Remember that you are valued, loved, and so truly blessed. Goodbye for now.
Thank you so much. I didn't get to say thank you.
All right. I'll shoot you an email.
Okay. Take care.